There we go.
Good afternoon, everybody. Do you have a good lunch? All right. Welcome from Hawaii. Welcome to the SharePoint Conference, and I hope you've had a great event so far. I know I certainly enjoyed the keynote and Bill Baer's session earlier this morning. And I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's session, which is Deployment Wizard, SharePoint 2013 Installation Tips, Tricks, and Scripts. My name is Dan Holm, and for those of you who don't know me yet, I'm an MVP in SharePoint Server. I have been for about 6 years, and prior to that was an MVP in Active Directory, Directory Services. I work for my own company, Intellium, and we are boutique training and consulting firm serving mostly large Fortune caliber organizations. And the one that I'm able to talk about publicly and that many of you have read about in my articles and blogs is NBC Universal, for whom I'm the Microsoft Technologies Consultant during the Olympic Games. And so this summer in London, I spent my fourth Olympics working with NBC, and in about 14 months, we'll be heading to Sochi, Russia for the 2014 Winter Olympic Games. I spend my life traveling the world, talking with large companies like NBC and others, and also writing books and articles. I did write the SharePoint 2010 training kit for any of you who are looking to get certified in that particular product. And about 1 week a month, I'm actually home, and I live in beautiful Maui, Hawaii, so I thought I'd share a couple of quick slides with you. If ever you're on Maui, please don't hesitate to give me a call. If it happens to be that 1 week a month I'm there, I'd love to see you and show you around. But the most important information on the slide is my contact information, and I highly recommend writing down that URL in the middle right now while I'm talking, because I definitely want this conversation to continue after today. My job is to help you be successful with SharePoint. My expertise ranges from infrastructure and architecture to governance to working in collaboration workloads and helping organizations align SharePoint with their strategic objectives. That's what I spend my time talking to everyone from C-level executives to IT teams to end users about. And I can only do my job effectively if we have a conversation. And the things I'm going to be sharing with you today are the product of my own experience as well as the experience of hundreds and hundreds and thousands of other folks just like you. So please stay in touch, whether through Facebook or Twitter. Twitter tends to be my professional SharePoint persona. Facebook is really just for personal stuff for me. And then the URL in the middle of the slide, tiny.cc/danholmspc2012, is my SkyDrive, where you will find all of the presentations that I'm delivering here at the SPC. My understanding is that they will be releasing the slide decks later on, and if you want to get an early copy of it, you can get it from there. I will also post to that same location the scripts that I share with you today, so that if you're interested in downloading them, you can get them from there. And that URL will be the same for all four of my presentations here at the event, so once you've written it down, you won't need it again. So that's a little bit about myself. About this session, we're going to cover deployment, and because this is the first day session, we're really going to try to cover as much as we can to ensure that you're able to successfully get SharePoint deployed into your organization. We're going to start with a very quick key points, best practices look at architecture. Then we're going to move into the hardware requirements for the servers in your farm and look at the actual deployment of SQL as well as SharePoint. One of our goals is going to be to automate deployment as much as possible. And so throughout this, we're going to be focused on what we can do to script installation so that by the time you're done, you have the opportunity to really turbocharge your deployment and use skills like image deployment, Windows deployment services, virtual machine manager, and tools like that to rapidly deploy images of SQL servers, of SharePoint servers, of dev farms, single server dev farms, whatever the case may be. So we got a lot to cover during this session. A couple of sort of caveats about it. First, if you're used to setup from SharePoint 2010, it hasn't actually changed that much, which is probably good news. What my experience has been, though, is that even people who were doing a lot of deployment in SharePoint 2010 never really took the time to master the slickness of it, meaning ways that you can script installation and make it automated for you. Also, I'm going to be sharing with you things that I've really tested on RTM versions of SharePoint 2013, and so there are going to be some nice new things you can do with both SQL 2012 and SharePoint 2013. We're also going to address the wonkiness aspects of deployment, things that are underdocumented, misdocumented, and unfortunately there still is some. This has just been a released product, and so some of what's on TechNet isn't necessarily 100% accurate. Conflicting documentation. And things that are simply not working, so that you have some heads up for things that won't work for you, as far as I can tell. We're going to be doing some demos, but because deployment is one of those things that you just sit and wait for the machine to go forever, I'm going to do what I call pseudo demos, and we'll so that we can click through things quickly. The demos I'm doing were all created based on SharePoint 2013 running on Windows Server 2008 R2, simply because there were too many moving parts with the release of Server 2012 and the release of SharePoint 2013 for me to build it all. But it is SharePoint 2013 on Windows Server 2008 R2. And so that's the way we're going to approach this session. So let's dive right in and start talking about architecture. Now, on Thursday, I've got a session called Architecting for Governance. And that is really about how you manage the service of SharePoint, how you create a logical architecture as well as a physical architecture to deliver what the business needs. Today, we're going to look at architecture from a purely sort of hardware standpoint. And we'll start by taking a look at one of the diagrams that's available for you on TechNet. Now, how many of you have seen this diagram already? Oh, wow. Good, good, good. How many of you like it? Oh, okay. Good. Then I wasn't sure. My next point will go over well then, which is I'm not a huge fan of this particular poster. I love the people who put these things together, but this one, my experience has been, tries to be too much to too many people. It tries to be both conceptual and prescriptive, and by doing that, it tends to fail. So we're going to break architecture down into the really core elements that will allow you to decide which of these topologies and the ones that aren't on this poster, more importantly, are right for you. So first, there are the server roles, and this is something that most of you are familiar with. SharePoint is an end-tier application. There are web servers that host the websites that your users access, and you can have you can even dedicate servers for crawling if you want to as you scale out. Behind that, there is the application server tier that runs your service applications, most importantly in 2013, your query and index service, as well as other search components and other service applications. And then there's the database tier, which of course is running SQL and hosts databases from content databases and search databases, configuration databases, et cetera. Now, you have the possibility in 2013, just as you did with 2010, to put all of those elements on a single server. So as the diagram, the picture suggests, we have our database, our applications, and our web all on one server. Obviously, that's going to have some constraints on performance. You can throw, 48 gigs of RAM and 15 SSDs at it, and it's still going to be fairly constrained on performance. And of course, there's no fault tolerance in this model, but it is supported and it's encouraged for things like deployment, evaluation, and for even very limited production deployments. And Microsoft's documentation at this point suggests a limited deployment would be around 100 users. So if you have a remote office that needs local team sites, for example, for that branch office, this might actually work for you. But you're definitely sacrificing both performance and, most importantly, fault tolerance. So now we move into those addressing those kinds of issues of scalability as well as fault tolerance or redundancy, however you want to think about it. What do we do to provide a scalable and fault-tolerant environment? So we start by looking at what the minimum fault-tolerant farm would be. And that is very simple. The idea is you have two of everything, right? You have two SharePoint servers. Those SharePoint servers are both web servers, so all of your sites are hosted and available on each, and they're load balanced. And then all of your service applications and service instances are running on both servers as well, and Service Central Administration is running on both. Just as in SharePoint 2010, almost everything can be made redundant with this simple design in SharePoint 2013. There's only a few components that aren't truly redundant in this design. So this will work. And in fact, at the Olympics this summer, for NBC, this is what we had. We had two front-end servers that were running everything. And from a scalability perspective, Microsoft suggests you can have up to 10,000 users being supported on a single SharePoint server. And so in our case, we had 5,000. That was plenty. Now, of course, you also have to have your SQL tier redundant as well. And there's several options for that. Clustering, SQL clustering. Mirroring, which, of course, was around in SharePoint 2010 with SQL 2008 as well. And then, of course, the new always-on availability groups that are available with SQL Server 2012. So with one of those things, you have a redundant tier on the back end as well. So this would be your minimal fault-tolerant farm. The poster suggests that you have to have two application servers. And yes, that's better for performance, but it's not the minimal fault-tolerance farm. Now, from there, you start scaling out to additional servers in order to achieve your fault tolerance and availability, redundancy, and scalability goals. So this diagram shows all of the tiers, including the load balancer, which is an important piece of the picture here. And these are the elements we have to work with. The load balancer And just a side note, in case you haven't heard it in one of the earlier sessions, it's no longer necessary to configure session stickiness in your load balancers with SharePoint 2013 because the new distributed cache caches your federated logon tokens. So it's probably not going to be necessary for you to configure stickiness. Then there's request management, which Bill covered in his session, which allows you to manage the routing of requests based on health and other types of rules. It does not replace your load balancer. It enhances the capabilities of your load balancer. And that particular service runs on all web servers by default. And the way you scale it out is simply to, the way you create fault tolerance, I should say, is simply to have more than two servers. So as long as you have more than two, your request management, A, has a reason for existence, and B, is fault tolerant. To scale this particular level of your service, you can actually create a dedicated request management farm that services more than one SharePoint farm. So that's a possibility for extremely scaled environments. Behind the request management comes the web tier, the websites themselves. And in that tier, again, 100 users on a single server limited deployment, 10,000 users per web server if you have three tiers. And to have redundancy, you simply have two or more web servers. All of your SharePoint web applications will be hosted on every web server by default, and then you can use your load balancer and routing to route requests to specific web servers. To scale, just keep adding more servers. So that tier is real simple. You have two, you have fault tolerance. More than that, you're starting to scale out. The distributed cache, which I mentioned a little bit earlier, and you've certainly heard about by this point in the event, is a new service in SharePoint 2013. It runs on all SharePoint servers by default, and it creates a cache that allows both the logon tokens to be cached across all servers so that you're again, don't need stickiness on your load balancer. And it also caches social activity so that when you're looking at your activity feeds, your news feeds and such, it's pulling it from the distributed cache. And based on how much memory you give to the dedicated cache, and how active your environment is, that's how much time you'll have from your activity feeds. So to scale this out, you can actually create dedicated servers that are doing only the distributed cache, or you can move the distributed cache onto application servers. So you can actually take this from its default, which is it runs on all servers, to running on specific servers to scale it out. Now, the redundancy story is a little bit more complicated with the distributed cache because it is distributed. And technically, if one of those servers fails, the timer job has to kick in to repopulate the cache across all the servers because they don't all maintain. It's not like they're replicas. They are truly a distributed cache of resources. And if you're going to take a server offline, you want to do it properly so that before it goes offline, the contents of its distributed cache get moved over to active servers. So the redundancy story is actually a little bit complicated on the distributed cache. Your data doesn't get lost, but it might take some time to repopulate. And then you move down to the application tier. And in the application tier, again, as long as you have two servers, you've got redundancy, as long as you're running the service instances on each of those servers. Then you scale out by adding additional servers and potentially dedicating servers to workloads in your environment. And that will then depend on what you're doing. Certainly search will deserve to get dedicated. We'll talk about that in a second. But if you're doing a lot of Excel services, you might choose to dedicate servers for that. If you're doing a lot of sandboxed code, you might choose to dedicate servers to that. So just based on your workload, you might add servers that are dedicated to specific workloads. Now, the one workload you're going to want to dedicate as soon as possible is the query component. The query component in SharePoint 2013 is quite different than it was in SharePoint 2010, and it has significantly greater requirements, the amount of memory and processor utilization, much, much higher now. The good side of that is it takes a lot of burden off of the SQL server that was there in SharePoint 2010. So your query components now are decreasing the burden on SQL. They then need more beef on their own, and so you're going to want to make sure, first of all, that you've got a redundant query service. In other words, you've got query components running on two or more servers. And then, you can replicate the index partition across those two servers as well. And then it's just a matter of scaling out to having that component be dedicated on additional servers with additional indexing. And there's more sessions about search and search architecture later in this event. But the bottom line story I want you to know now is that this is more important even than in 2010 that you start dedicating your query components soon. As you've heard in several sessions, Office Web Apps is now no longer built into SharePoint. It's its own product, so that will be its own farm. Redundancy is two or more servers. Scale is more than two servers. So that's an easy one. And then down to the database tier, as we mentioned, redundancy is mirroring, clustering, or always-on availability groups in 2012. And scale is, on the database side, is adding additional SQL instances dedicated to specific workloads. SQL optimizes itself based on the type of database it's working with. So as you scale out, you put your content databases in one instance, and that optimizes itself. You put your search databases in another, and you can put your configuration in all other databases either with content or on a third set of instances. And you scale out based on the workloads of those databases. So with all of that said, it actually is pretty easy. It's a matter of saying, okay, if we've got two, we've got redundancy. If we want to scale out, we add more, and then we start dedicating based on workloads. And all that poster is doing is mixing all those things together and then making it more complicated by throwing in physical and virtual environments. And physical and virtual is not a tough variable to figure out. Do you put it on physical or do you put it on virtual? It boils down to really two things. First, performance. It's all about performance. If you have enough resources given to a virtual machine, RAM, cores, I/O, network, your virtual machine can perform extremely well. In fact, I'm seeing more and more customers starting to virtualize SQL Server 2012 for SharePoint because on Windows Server 2012, Hyper-V is so much more scalable and gives its resources to the virtual environments so much more effectively that the penalty you have for virtualizing SQL is nearing zero. And on the other side of performance, you get manageability. The ability to replicate VMs, move VMs around between physical hosts. So it's really a matter of, is the performance hit that you may or may not get by virtualizing a bigger cost than the benefit you get by reduced hardware costs and manageability? And you just make the decision based on that. It doesn't impact your architecture per se. It's almost a separate discussion. So you can decide how many servers you need, and then you can decide whether those need to be physical or virtual. And again, if you're looking at Windows Server 2012 and Hyper-V 3.0, you have a lot more capability to move forward with virtualization because it is a significantly better product. And my colleagues who really specialize in virtualization are really excited about Hyper-V 3.0. Everyone sort of believes that Microsoft is actually ahead of VMware now. And luckily, that means there'll be a leapfrog game now instead of Microsoft being constantly behind. And that's a great thing, or at least constantly behind in the perception of the market. So that's where we are then. You need to put together what your business is trying to do with the technical considerations of performance, scalability, redundancy, and manageability, factor it in with cost, and do the math to come up with the equation. And all of those things go into the mix, and it's not a real simple thing to come up with because business needs and cost are tough to deal with. Technical part is easy. The business needs and the cost become more challenging. And one of the things that is really important to remember with architecture is there is no best practice. Architecture is a function of having good technical expertise and understanding what the issues are, having a good process to be able to take business needs and costs into consideration, and then make compromises. That's all architecture is. And it's true on the physical architecture that we've just talked about. It's really true as we get to the service architecture that we'll be talking about on Thursday. So with the architecture under our belts then, let's move to the hardware requirements of those servers in our farm. If we're doing a single server environment, Microsoft wants us to give that environment more resources than we did in SharePoint 2010, specifically for cores, 8 gigs of RAM if you're doing foundation, and 24 gigs of RAM if you're doing server. That's for a single server environment. Now, that sounds like a lot, and it is. I can tell you I know lots of people who are doing dev and evaluation on 4 or even 8 or 8 or even 4 gigs of RAM. It does start getting tight, but you can turn things off as well. You can turn off the distributed cache service. If you're not developing or testing the social capabilities and you're not having to worry about federated logon tokens being cached across multiple servers, turn that off. You can crank down several other things as well. So you can create dev and evaluation environments on 8 gigs of RAM on a single server, but if you're going to be doing it in production, you probably should be looking at these kinds of figures or simply scaling out to a bigger farm. And as soon as you go into multiple tiers, your RAM requirements do drop. In a multiple tier structure, the minimum suggested RAM is 12 gigabytes of RAM, again, 4 cores. And then on the database size, 8 gigs of RAM and 4 cores for small deployments, 16 gigs of RAM and 8 cores for large deployments. Now, all of these hardware requirements are detailed in the links that are in the slide deck. I will tell you that there is a lot of different guidance out there about hardware. There's a lot of information that came out during preview that some of it's getting revised. I'm hearing different things from different people in the Microsoft product group. There's a lot of noise out there. In the end, it's just a matter of testing it, right? You're not going to roll out an environment without testing it and knowing it's going to be successful. So give it as much resource as you can based on cost and business needs and try to hit at least these minimums. And the more you can give it, obviously, the better. Now, once you've got your hardware identified, you're ready to prepare for installation. And one of the key points in preparing for installation is to make sure that you have the right service accounts in your environment. And one of my big areas of interest is ensuring that the customers that I work with have least privilege environments, where accounts only have the privileges they really need for the job of that account. And so starting in SharePoint 2010, I really beat up least privilege. We found some bugs in it. Those have been mostly fixed. And the guidance in 2013 hasn't changed a whole lot on service accounts. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to point you to the detailed references. TechNet has some great articles. And then I'm going to hit a couple of the most important points that I end up finding myself talking about with customers. So the first of which is, which accounts do you need? And this is just a simple list. And again, the TechNet articles detail each of these. If you're deploying SQL for SharePoint, and you're going to do it on multiple on a cluster, you're going to need an account for that SQL service. And we'll come back and talk about this one later. You're going to need an account for the SQL administrator, and we'll talk about that one later as well. The SharePoint administrator, the farm account, which is your SharePoint service account, separate accounts for your app pools, and I highly recommend having one account for your web apps and one for your service apps to create a security boundary between them. And then each additional app pool you create, you generally will want to create an account for. And last but not least, crawling and user profile synchronization. So this list is actually identical to what it was in SharePoint 2013. These are the key, 2010. These are the key accounts. The ones I want to hit first are the SP admin account. Microsoft calls this the SharePoint setup user account. I like to call it the SharePoint administrator and setup user account, because what this account is meant to do is to be used by an administrator, a human being, to perform bit level changes to the farm. That means installing SharePoint, adding products, adding language packs, adding updates and patches, and doing the very, very initial PS config. So this is used for performing bit level changes in your environment. This account needs to be a unique, generic account, not your user account. And the reason is that the account that's used for this gets tattooed into all kinds of places. It gets DBO rights in certain places in SQL. It gets permissions to registry keys and file shares. And if you then get promoted out and your company really wants to clean up the environment for the next administrator who's coming in, that's going to be a lot of work. The bits are not owned by me as an administrator. The bits are owned by my enterprise. And that's what this represents, is that the enterprise owns the bits. So I'm logging on with an account that represents the enterprise's ownership of the bits. I do the bit level changes. And then as soon as I'm done with those bit level changes, my setup is finished, I add my administrative account into farm administrators and everywhere else it needs to be. That's basically the enterprise delegating to me what I need to get my job done as an administrator. And from that point forward, I'm logging on as my administrative account until it comes time to add a patch, a service pack, a cumulative update, et cetera, a bit level change back to SP admin. So this is an important thing to do, and this isn't just true for SharePoint, it's true for SQL and Exchange, and any service you're deploying, you want to try and have an account that represents the enterprise, not you. And last but not least, this account can be locked down when you're not making those changes. So if your Active Directory team is concerned about security, they can disable this until the moment you need to actually install a patch or an update. That's totally fine. Another account that I think is important to consider is what I call the Uber admin account, the SharePoint Enterprise Administrator. And I wish this wasn't necessary, but it is. This is the forget least privilege account. Because unfortunately, there are certain things where least privilege isn't possible in a large, and you see this particularly in larger environments where a SQL team is separate than the SharePoint team. And when you, for example, go to install a patch or an upgrade, an update, you need to be able to make changes to the database that you can't make as simply SP admin. You need to have an account that can be an administrator both on the SQL side and on the SharePoint side. And so this account can be used in those rare situations where something needs to be done that requires significant rights in both the SQL and the SharePoint environments. One of the other places this account is necessary is if you're doing a really good job of least privilege, is in delegating your administrator, your first administrators, the ability to use PowerShell to administer SharePoint. You have to use that add spshell commandlet. That has to be done with super high-level credentials that have permissions both on the SharePoint servers in the farm as well as on the SQL databases in the farm. So to get that sort of Uber-level permission, you need to create this account. It can be disabled until you need it, but it's good to have in your back pocket. And last but not least, with all of these accounts, you're going to have multiple farms, I hope. At least a dev, a test, and a production farm. And in those farms, each farm needs its own set of accounts. And there are several reasons for that, including least privilege, because you might need to be playing with permissions in your test environment that you don't want to be taking effect in your production environment. Monitoring and auditing. If I'm if I'm looking at an event log and I see one account that might be doing something on three different farms, I don't know where that account is causing problems. If I see it's the spfarm_test account, I know that that's in my test farm and that's the account I need to be looking at. And last but not least, automatic password management. SharePoint 2010 introduced managed service accounts, which basically enables SharePoint to change the password on your service accounts automatically so you don't have to. That's a great, great feature, but it's farm specific. So you need to have a separate set of accounts for each farm. Otherwise, when one farm changes the passwords, the other farms won't know about the change and they'll break. So you need to consider the fact that each farm is going to need its own set of accounts in your naming conventions and figure out what kinds of names you're going to use to represent the different farms in your environment. And I can tell you, when you go to your Active Directory team and say, here's the list of 25 accounts I need for SharePoint, there might be a little debate that comes up. And I'm in this debate. I'm in the center of this debate all the time because of my Active Directory background. So I give you two pieces of advice. One is, if your Active Directory team barks at you, just say, okay, just give me a domain admin account. Because that is the option. It's either least privilege or it's not. You're going to have one domain admin account, and everything will work beautifully running as that account. Every developer I know uses one of those accounts. Or, if that doesn't work, have them email me, because chances are they've heard of me if they're in Active Directory, and I'll say, dudes, make those accounts. It's stupid. You have to have those accounts. So it is a debate you're likely to have, but the answer is either they do their job and create a least privileged environment, or they give you an Uber account. Either way. Now we're ready to actually get the bits going. And the first machine we're going to deploy is SQL. So in the SQL space, we are going to get the SQL server ready. And by the way, for those of you who might have been traveling or not following Twitter, SQL Server 2012 with SP1 was released on Thursday. So that is now out in the wild. My experience is the download from MSDN actually says it's SP1 but isn't. So watch out for that. But the ones that you can download from the downloads page on Microsoft's site, the normal public downloads page, seem to be correct. You're going to log on to your SQL Server as your SQL_admin account. So this is one of those places I'm using a generic account representing the enterprise's ownership of SQL, and we're going to do these things as SQL admin. It has to be an administrator on the server, and then we're going to install .NET Framework 3.5.1. That is required for SQL Server 2012 for sure, and you can either do it in the UI and Server Manager, or you can use the two-line PowerShell commandlet that's right there, import Server Manager, and then add Windows Feature Net Framework. So either PowerShell scripted or UI, you do have to install that first. After you've installed that, and by the way, there's more resources for you at that link. After you've done that, you're ready to run setup.exe. This is one of those things that takes a while, so I'm hopefully going to be able to jump in mid-demo here. And let's see if my machines will cooperate with me. So I've already started running setup here, and we've already gotten through all the rule checking and all those kinds of things, and we're kind of at the core part of setup where we can click through, and I'm going to cross my fingers here, yes. So we can choose to install SQL features. That's what we want to do. Click next. It then gives us the list of features to install, and we're going to want to install the database engine as well as the management tools. Now, there's depending on the workload, you might have additional features that you want to install. Certainly, access services, business intelligence, they all require additional features. Now, what's going on here? My machines may not work with me today. For anyone who's been following me, you know I've been having absolutely tech hell for the last 3 weeks, so this is not a surprise. Yeah, exactly. It's Adobe's fault. All right, we're not going to do that one. We'll keep going. So you might have, these are the features you need to check in the little tree, you might have additional features you need to install based on the workloads you're installing. And by the way, one of the resources I personally am looking for, I'm looking for a really good matrix of if you're using this feature, these are the SQL features you need, by someone who's really tested it. Because what I find is people over-install SQL, and I'd really love to see that matrix. So if any of you have it, please shoot it to me. And then you're ready, after that step, to assign the SQL service accounts. This is one I really would have liked to show you. So this is new in SQL 2012. In SQL 2012, you now have the ability to create a truly least privileged SQL installation. And the deal is that when you're doing a single server installation of SQL, you no longer need to use a domain account for your agent, your SQL database engine. Instead, it's got this new thing called virtual accounts, which is almost like network service and local service and those kinds of accounts, but it's a new special thing. And it's the default. So when you see those, don't be surprised. If you're doing a single server installation of SQL, that is the least privileged choice. You can also choose to use a slightly older capability called managed service accounts, which were introduced in Active Directory Server 2008 R2, which basically allow you to create an account in Active Directory that's targeted to a single computer and the services on that computer. And then Active Directory is able to, the computer is able to update that account's passwords automatically so that it's like a service account with an automatic changing password. And that's possible as well on a single server. If you're using a cluster, however, you do need to use domain accounts, which is more like the older guidance. And so you would have a domain account such as SQL underscore service that would be assigned to the services on both nodes in the cluster. But if you're doing a single server install, you can use virtual accounts. Slightly new little thing. There's some references on all these things on the slide deck for you as well. Now, once you've gotten to the last step of setup, setup tells you your final configuration and says click install, and if you click install, it's going to start going. But at that moment, it also tells you where your configuration file is loaded. And your configuration file is a great little tool. It's a great little tool, and let's see if I can show you that successfully here. So let's see. It is under SQL. I'm sure you all can read that, right? Let's see. So what happens is while you're using setup in the SQL setup process, it is creating an answer file for you. It is creating a script. It's called the configuration file. And again, right when you click install, it tells you the exact path to that file. And when you open it up, it's just a bunch of parameters that relate to every single thing you chose in the interface. This can then be used as a script for SQL installation. So you literally could cancel right at that moment and then rerun setup against this answer file with a couple of small changes we'll talk about, and you would now have a script. So it produces an almost perfect script for you. Now, you are going to need to make a couple of small changes to the default answer file because it doesn't by default agree to the license terms for you. You have to add that into the answer file as Microsoft's little way of making sure that you do in fact agree to the license terms. So you have to add the I accept SQL server license terms equals true value. You need to add the product ID if you're not using an eval version. You need to comment out the UI mode node, and you need to change quiet equals true. So there's four changes. They're all at the top of the file. You add agreement to the license terms. You add their product ID if you need to. You comment out the UI mode. That keeps the UI from appearing. And if it does appear, it actually conflicts and doesn't work. It fails. And it tells you that. And then last but not least, you set quiet equals true. And now you run setup.exe with that answer file by simply using the slash configuration file equals parameter. Point to your configuration file, and it's now scripted. So you now have a completely scripted install of SQL that you can replicate across your different environments. And the answer file is really easy, and there's some of the references I have for you go into the details of the answer file, but you'll find it's very easy, it's well commented, so if you need to make changes to it in different environments, you're going to find that easy to do. Once SQL has been installed, you're going to need to make a couple of final changes to the SQL server. Assuming this is a multi-tier environment, you're going to need to open up the firewall to allow SQL to communicate to the outside world to communicate to SQL. You can use the netsh command, which is a legacy. It's being deprecated, but it still works, so I have it there because it's simple. There's other ways to do it as well. There's a link in TechNet that tells you how to change it to a different port, and I open up that port as well. But it's as simple as using the netsh firewall command to open up port 1433 so the world can get into SQL. That's the only networking level change you need to make. If you want to lock it down further, there's two good white papers on TechNet for how to do that. And most of the guidance that applied to SQL Server 2008 R2 and SharePoint 2010 still applies in the SharePoint 2013 space. Now, one little but very important note. This is one that if you don't watch, it's going to bonk you. So little thing here. It's called max degree of parallelism. This is something that SharePoint 2013 now requires, and it's not on by default. So you will be halfway through the installation of SharePoint, and it will give you this archaic, weird message about MDOP, and you need to know what it is. So MDOP, maximum degree of parallelism, is actually about how much resources get dedicated to SQL, particularly during queries. The default in SQL, 2008 R2 and 2012, is zero. Unfortunately, in SharePoint 2010, you should have set it to one. It was actually a best practice. It was recommended. It was buried in all the white papers. I'm sure you missed the one-liner. But if you haven't set this to one in your current environment, go do it. It will help. It will improve performance. In SharePoint 2013, it's required, and setup will fail. The PS config, the product's configuration wizard, will fail if you don't have this set up correctly. So you do need to turn this on. And you can do it in the UI. The resources I have linked for you tell you how to do it in the UI. Or you can use a PowerShell script. And this script shows you how to do it. The key is you're building a SQL query. The SQL query is setting max degree of parallelism to 1. And if you're doing it on anything other than the default instance, you include that parameter. And you just pull up PowerShell on your SQL server, because your SQL server has the SQL server module for PowerShell, and you run that script, and it will work. There's no tweaks necessary. And this is one of the scripts that I'll put in the SkyDrive for you. Last but not least, you need to get ready to install SharePoint. On the SQL server, you need to delegate the login for the SP admin account. And this is exactly the same as it was in 2010. You need to create a login for SP admin, your setup user administrator account, and you need to give it the DB creator and security admin roles. Remember, you're going to be logging on as a human being, as SP admin, to install SharePoint. When you install SharePoint, you are going to be creating the farm configuration database, so you need the DB creator permission. You are then going to delegate permissions to that database to your farm account, so you need to be able to change permissions on that database, which is the security admin role. So those two roles allow you to create the first databases and then turn them over to the farm account, and from that point on, the farm can do everything it needs to do. So that's the same as in 2010. So now we've got SQL ready. We can install SharePoint. And to install SharePoint, we have a server. We're going to log on as SP admin, which we've talked about already. It needs to be in the administrators group of that server, as well as the roles on SQL. And then installing SharePoint is the same four broad steps it was in 2010. You're going to install the prerequisites. You're then going to install the binaries, which means installing all the services and bits of SharePoint, but not turning anything on. You're then going to configure SharePoint, meaning turning everything on and telling that server to be part of a farm or to create a new farm. And last but not least, you're going to configure the farm itself, all of the service applications. And each of these things can be automated using slightly different processes. So we're going to see how to automate every single one of these things, starting with the SharePoint prerequisites. So as in 2010, you have to get a whole bunch of things onto the machine before you can install SharePoint 2013. This is the list. And just like in 2010, there is a tool called the prerequisite installer that's right at the root of your SharePoint installation files that will allow you to download and install these prerequisites automatically. So you could just double-click and run the prerequisite installer. So we're going to do a quick little what I call pseudo-demo here, which is, again, save us a little bit of time. So let's click through this here. So if you are installing SharePoint, the splash screen appears, and then you click Install Software Prerequisites. It has to run as administrator, so it prompts you for elevation. The prerequisite installer appears, tells you what it's going to install. You click Next. You agree to the license terms. Click Next. And then it goes through the process. And this is what takes a lot of time. So we're going to pretend like we just blasted through time, and we're done. That's what we're looking for. Now, there may be some restarts in the middle of that, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But the bottom line is it installs, downloads and installs all of the prerequisites for you. Now, obviously, that's going to take some time to download all these prerequisites. If you're doing multiple servers, that could take a lot of time. And many of us, I think, don't let our servers go out to the internet in the first place. And so it's a good idea to be able to install these prerequisites from a local source, from a network share, maybe from the local hard drive of the server, what it doesn't matter. But you can do that. You simply download all the prerequisites, and we'll talk about how to do that. You download all the prerequisites, and then the prerequisite installer command allows you to use switches, and the switches are all documented on this slide. All you have to do is point to the path where you're putting all these things, your network share. So you can either create a giant command line that has all of those switches on it, or you can create what's called a prerequisite installer.txt file. Let me show you what that looks like. Prerequisite installer arguments. So let's see. in my SharePoint 2013 folder. There's the prerequisite installer itself. And this is the file that I've already created that we're going to talk about, prerequisite installer arguments. And this is what it looks like. Oops, that's. You can see it's pretty hard to read. All of those switches are on one line. No line breaks. It will actually, the prerequisite installer will barf at you if you put any line breaks in. It's one line, but we're seeing it with word wrap on. And in there is every single prerequisite that was on the slide, which the only thing that's different is that the path is filled into the path in my world. So this is the file. To make your life easier, I've created a generic version of this file that I will put in the SkyDrive. All you need to do is search and replace for bracket path with your file share, and that will work for you because all of us need the same prerequisites. So I'll put that up there for you. And then the only other trick is that what you name this file. After you create it, when you go to save, you actually have to call it prerequisite installer.arguments.text. So let me zoom in so you can see this here. It actually takes two extensions, which is a little bit funky, but that's what it does. And it has to be in the exact same folder as prerequisiteinstaller.exe. So if this file is there, if it has the right name, and if it's got all the switches, you now have a completely unattended installation of the prerequisites. And again, this little bit hasn't changed since 2010. It's just different prerequisites. So as it mentions at the bottom of the slide, all switches are in one line, the file has two extensions, and it has to be in the same folder. And if you need any more details, it's on TechNet. However, this particular article does have some errors in it, so if you see anything different in it than what I have, use what's in my slides. It's not big differences, but there are a couple of little ones. You might go, well, Dan said this. Dan's tested it. It works. Now, there's some problems. Now, there's an asterisk here because I'm going to say I've run into some problems, and I'm going to share with you my experience. If any of you have had different experiences, please catch me after the session and let me know. And if any of you have answers to these problems, please catch me after the session and let me know, and I'll put what I find out in the SkyDrive for everybody. But there are two problems, one of which is well documented on TechNet if you go through it, which is a buggy restart of the prerequisite installer. If your prerequisite installer requires your system to restart, it will tell you, it will come up with a little window here that says you need to restart. Don't click finish. Because if you do, it restarts with a switch that doesn't actually work. And the next time it restarts, it ignores your answer file locations, and it goes to the internet and starts downloading whatever's left. So you need to click cancel, and then you go into your program data folder, and you will see the startup task, and you have to delete that. So the steps are here on the slide. You click cancel, you go into that path, you delete the startup task, and then you restart the machine and run prerequisite installer manually. Just double-click it, and it will see your answer file and continue on wherever it left off. So it's good at picking up where it left off. The problem is, the bug is, that it, when it does that, it starts going out to the internet again in the default behavior. So you do need to watch for that. The other big bug that I've discovered, and this is one that I'd be very interested after the session to find out if anyone's fixed, is the WCF data services prerequisite, which is one of the prerequisites, doesn't actually work in a disconnected environment. The whole point of this scenario in my head is to allow us to have servers that don't talk to the internet. Unfortunately, this particular prerequisite, even if you just download it from Microsoft's site on a USB key, go over to your server, plug it in, double click, it fails because the certificate is bad and it doesn't recognize it as a signed publisher, and your server will bark at you and won't let you install it. And so if your server's not connected to the internet, your prerequisite installer will just hang and it will never finish. So unfortunately, my guidance to you right now is, at least during the installation of this particular prerequisite, you do have to have your server connected to the internet. And if anyone has a better solution for me, I would love to hear it, because I have a lot of military clients who don't connect any servers to the internet at all. So I'd love to know how to fix that. Last but not least, the prerequisite installer installs all of your prerequisites except for the prerequisites that it doesn't install. There are three additional prerequisites that you have to install manually. They're listed here, and in the slide, these are actually links to the prerequisites. You can download them. Unfortunately, some of these are those really hairy hot fixes where you have to put in your email address and it sends you a code, and you have to download it and unzip it. Ugh. But that's the way it is. There's three hot fixes that have to be installed, and you have to do it after you install the prerequisites. At one of my customers, I made the mistake of scripting this before the prerequisite installer, baking it into the image, and then we realized that these hot fixes apply to the things that the prerequisite installer is installing. So it failed. So these have to be done after the prerequisite installer. And you can automate this with the little script that I have on the slide for you. So assuming you've put them somewhere in the same location as the script, you can run the script against them and it will automate the installation. And then ideally you should restart the computer. I have that commented out in the script, but you should restart the computer. It would be nice if the prerequisite installer actually installed all of your prerequisites. I think we all would love that. It just doesn't work. Microsoft had obviously a lot of other big priorities in this particular release of SharePoint. So hopefully this will, hopefully the prerequisite installation story will improve over time. Last but not least, there's disabling loopback. And this is something that everyone with SharePoint has dealt with. There's an explanation on TechNet, and I have a script here for how to do it. The bottom line is if you don't do this, you will not be able to, for example, log on to your SharePoint server and get to sites on the same server. You also search crawls will start to have problems. So if you're not familiar with this issue, check it out on TechNet and read up on it. But there is a script there for how to poke that registry entry in for you. So once the prerequisites are installed, you're ready to now run setup.exe with SharePoint. And so let's click through and see what that would look like in the UI. So in the UI, we double-click setup.exe. Again, it has to run with elevated credentials, and we have to enter our product key and click continue. Have to agree to the license agreement, always. And then we get this wonderful box that has been here since forever. And one great bit of good news is they fixed the terminology on this page. I don't know if you remember 2010, but it's like it asked you the same question twice, it changed the wording, and it flipped the default order just to make it really confusing. And I remember I talked to some of the people on the product team back when 2010 was released. I said, why do you ask the same question twice and change the defaults? They're like, oh, it has to be there for hooks from other applications. Well, now it's the right words, and it asks you once, so I'm just saying. But it does make it a lot clearer here. A complete installation for production environments or a standalone installation for trial and deployment environments. Complete is the default, which it should be, which means you're installing SharePoint and you have SQL already installed somewhere else. So this is now a nice page. And then we can click through. This, again, takes several minutes, so we're going to warp through time. And when it's all done, we get the finished notification for this step. So now at this point, SharePoint is installed on the machine. All the bits are there, all the services are registered, but nothing's turned on. The server isn't part of a farm. It hasn't created its own farm. It's sort of a neutral server. And that's going to be important for us later because this is what we're going to image if we want to deploy SharePoint with images. This is the state that we're going to use. It has to be done now before everything's turned on and part of a farm. So we've installed we've seen how it looks in the interface. And once we're done with that, we would install the latest cumulative updates. There aren't any yet for 2013, but there will be. And I'm a fan. You need to make sure that all the servers in your farm are at the same patch level. I think we all know that. And generally speaking, I'm a fan of when I'm installing a new server in a farm, getting it completely up to date before I run the products and configuration wizard. Because if you add a patch, you have to run the products configuration wizard again anyway. So you install everything up front. You only have to run the products configuration wizard one time. Just saves a little bit of step. So assuming that you want to get the server up to the same patch level as all of the existing servers in your farm, you install the latest cumulative updates once they're there. Now, this script is different. Each of these phases uses a slightly different way of scripting itself. In this case, we are going to use config.xml. So let's jump back to our machine and take a look at what this looks like. Microsoft is nice enough to give us a directory on the SharePoint distribution called files. And in that, there is a subdirectory for six different types of installation. Let me resume in on that. We have a normal installation, which would prompt us for everything we need to know. We've got a farm configuration. And the difference here is this is going to be our standalone. And this is going to be where we have a multiple-tier farm with SQL somewhere else. And we have the same option there with a silent mode option. Then we have the upgrade options. So we have upgrade, standalone, and complete, either silent or not. Those are the different dimensions we have. And inside these folders, we pick the one we're doing. So let's say we want to set up the first server in a farm silently. We go into the setup farm silent folder, and we see a file called config.xml. We open that up. And this is the script. Again, this comes with SharePoint, so there's no magic here. The only magic is we have to make one change, which is the product ID. So you'll notice about halfway down, there's a PID key value. Whoops. This is what we need to change. So we enter our product key here, and then we have to get rid of the comment tags at the beginning and the end of the line. Those make it a those comment out the line. So we get rid of those comment tags, and when we're all done, we have an answer file, a config.xml answer file. So it's one or two, if you want to count it that way, changes to this file. Once we've made those changes, we simply run setup.exe with the slash config switch, followed by a space this time instead of an equal sign like SQL, because Microsoft likes being inconsistent to make our job more interesting. Path and then config.xml. So you're pointing to config.xml with setup.exe. So that's a very simple one to script the installation of the SharePoint binaries. If you want to monitor the installation, you can look at the log, you can follow the processes. It will be quiet. There's nothing that comes up at the end that says, okay, SharePoint's ready for you to finish. It is completely unattended. Now, the final step is then turning on all the services, joining the farm, or creating a new farm. So this is the SharePoint Products and Configuration Wizard, or PS Config UI, as you might know it. And so in this particular instance, we're going to, we're going to run the SharePoint Products Configuration Wizard from the Start menu. Click Next. It's going to tell us that it's going to temporarily disable all sites. Now, when you're first creating a farm, this is no big deal. It's a brand new farm. There's no sites. The reason they give you this message is because you're also going to run this same wizard after you install a language pack, a cumulative update, and those kinds of things. So that's why it's giving you this message, is because in a production environment, you're updating. You need to be reminded that there's going to be a disruption in service. We get to choose whether we connect to a new farm or an existing farm. We're going to create a new farm. By the way, does everyone recognize this from 2010? This has changed exactly zero. I think they ran out of interns to change the branding on things this summer. It's interesting, this is the one thing that looks exactly the same as it always did. Even the terminology is the same. Nothing's changed. So in here, we put our database server. Now, the database server name, I highly recommend making a SQL alias. And we'll talk about this tomorrow when Jeremy and I do our SharePoint Demystified session. It's a fake name for your SQL server, which allows you to then move SQL around to different places without having to change all the names that SharePoint thinks of. So we'll talk about this tomorrow, but a SQL alias is a best practice. And then we put in our farm username and farm password. Now, this account in this particular UI, and many of you will know this already, but this is your opportunity as a human administrator of SharePoint to delegate to the farm the ability to work with the databases in SQL. So what this is really asking you for is your farm account. It says database access. It would be clearer if it just said your farm service account. And this is why you need to be a security admin in SQL, because after you create this database, you're going to give permissions to that database. You're going to basically assign ownership, in fact, to the farm account so it can make all the changes it needs to make on a day-to-day basis. We put in a farm passphrase, same as we did in 2010, and then we can set a port number for central administration, and we can choose to keep NTLM or go with Kerberos. My recommendation is keep NTLM when you're creating a new farm until you've got everything up and running, because if Kerberos is broken, you don't want to have wasted an hour installing SharePoint and not be able to get to central administration. So start with NTLM, and then you can switch it later. All right, and with that, then, we finished the wizard. About 12 minutes later or so, depending on your hardware, the configuration is successful, and that is the configuration step of installation. Now, this particular step is automated with PowerShell. So fourth step, fourth different way of doing things. And the script and the commandlets you're going to use to initialize your farm, to create the first server in the farm, are to create a new configuration database, initialize security, install all the features, and these commandlets are, in fact, exactly the same as they were in 2010. They still work in 2013. And let me show you the script that I'll be giving you to help you do this. Oops, hopefully I have it. What did I? Let me see here. No, I can't show it to you. So I, but I will put it up on the in the SkyDrive, and the URL again is there, tiny.cc/danholmspc2012. What this PowerShell script does is it's a very clean script where all of the variables are upfront, so anything you need to customize will be really blatantly obvious to you. You customize it, and it scripts the first server in your farm. Within the next week or two, I'll add the script to add additional servers to the farm, so you might come back to the same SkyDrive, and I'll get the additional server script built up there. But you'll see, it's a nice, clean script. The main thing I was going to show you is that all the variables are right there. Your account names, the port you want central administration on, the name of your administration and configuration databases, they're all right at the top and easy for you to change. At that point, you now have a farm, or you've joined a server to a farm. And from that point forward, it's all about configuring your applications. And configuring your websites. And there are sessions throughout this event that focus on what you do once the bits are on the machine, so I'm not going to focus as much on those parts, except to point you to my favorite resources for working with automated deployment of these things. So first, there's the PowerShell sessions here and the individual feature sessions here at the SPC. Then, among my favorite resources are Gary LaPointe's blog and Todd Klint's blog. They both do a lot of blogging about PowerShell. They found a lot of the tips and tricks and places you can stub your toe, and they blog about them. One thing I will point out is that with 2013, it does seem like there are a few things that aren't quite, what should we say, as, well, maybe they were done by Adobe. There are a few PowerShell commandlets that when you run them don't set the settings that you really kind of need, and the only way to get to those settings is through the UI or through deep dotting in your PowerShell. So there are a few things, and Todd has blogged about them, that are still a little bit less than perfectly clean when you go to install some of the more complex, and particularly the newer service applications. One last note is I know many of you have looked at AutoSP Installer, which is a product on CodePlex. This is a community project that really focuses on creating the perfect PowerShell script from bare metal to full farm. Full multi-server farm, full distributed architecture farm. It can be a quite powerful and rich solution. I've had good, my customers that have used this tool have had good luck with it. I actually use a tool that that Gary wrote that's very similar. And if you're doing complex farms, I highly recommend looking at that solution. Also, if you're interested in how to do things with PowerShell, dig into its scripts. Scripts are just text files. You can go in and see how they did it, and that might help you figure out how to do what you're trying to do to your farm. So at this point now, we've installed all the bits. We've talked about all the different ways you automate each of the bits. And now we kind of need to put it all together and think about how we're going to deploy in a turbocharged fashion. And when I say turbocharged, I mean things like images. So rather than having to even run a script, we can simply blast out a perfect image of a SQL server or a SharePoint server. And we can get pretty close to that perfect world. Starting with SQL. With SQL 2010, SQL 2008 R2, as well as SQL 2012, you have the ability to sysprep SQL. This was not possible prior to that. And so you run setup.exe, and from the advanced installation, instead of choosing to install SQL, you choose to prepare the installation. And what that does is it takes you basically two-thirds of the way through installation. It lays down all the bits for the features that you want, and you can only install a limited number of features this way, including, luckily, the database engine. And you can even capture that as a configuration file if you want to. And then you run sysprep. So you're basically creating a two-thirds finished SQL server, and then you're sysprepping it. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with sysprep is a tool that comes, it's part of Windows. It's in System 32 sysprep. And what sysprep does is it genericizes a machine. It makes it so that it takes away all the little uniquenesses, including things like the machine name, some of the different GUIDs that are used here and there inside of Windows and services, and then shuts the machine down. And once it's shut down as a generic machine, you can now do whatever you want with that disk drive. You can physically duplicate the disk drive. You can use your favorite deployment tool to take an image of the disk drive and deploy it. And wherever you copy that disk drive, what you're copying is a generic drive that then when it starts up, will become the unique new machine that you're trying to deploy. So sysprep is literally preparing the system for deployment. It looks something like this. You have your SQL, you have the server that you want SQL to be on, and you run setup.exe, and you choose to prepare the installation. And then when SQL tells you it's ready, you go and run sysprep. And sysprep then genericizes the machine. You can think of it as stripping out all of its uniquenesses. At that point, then, you use whatever tool you have at your disposal to duplicate that image. You might physically duplicate disk drives. You might be using, Symantec or Microsoft's deployment tools, Alteryx, whatever. And you can now deploy that. And each one you deploy is generic. Now you start up one of those machines, and when you start up a machine that's been deployed this way, it goes through a mini setup where it asks you basically what language and region do you want to use, what's the machine name, and it does a scan for hardware to see if it needs to install different drivers based on the system it's now on. So mini setup now runs and gives you basically what you started with before you ran sysprep, but now it's a unique new machine. The final step then is to finish server configuration, which means assigning IP addresses, joining the domain, and all of this can be scripted, by the way. And then when all that's finished, you go back to SQL setup, and you run setup.exe, and instead of installing SQL, you choose to complete the installation. And it does the last little bit where it turns on all the services on that machine and does the things that need to be done on a unique machine basis. So you can deploy the image, which saves actually quite a bit of time, and then just run the little SQL completion, and that too can be scripted. You can capture it as a config.ini file, and you can run setup.exe/config and /configuration file, and you can script that little bit as well. So you end up with a unique SQL server. And on the slides in the notes, there's actually a set of links to all the detailed step-by-steps that are on TechNet. The one thing I found with the TechNet documentation is that some of the SharePoint docs say one thing, some of the SQL docs say another. And again, what I've done, I've actually tested, and I can tell you it works. So if there's a conflict, just use the information that I've given you. Now, the one step that I left a little bit vague here is how you actually capture and deploy the image. And so let's talk about that as well. Deploying an image really is not a SharePoint-specific thing or a SQL-specific thing. It's a Windows technology. And Microsoft actually gives us all the tools we need to create, manage, and deploy images. A lot of organizations that I work with still continue to pay big money for third-party tools that do image deployment when Microsoft's tools are actually really, really quite good. And they are also very rich and powerful. So there's 90-minute sessions at TechEd about how to use the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit and the Windows Assessment and Deployment Kit. They're a complex set of tools, but it can be as simple as booting a machine. So you've got your perfect machine, and you've sysprepped it, and it's powered down. You boot it to a CD or a USB key that has what's called WinPE on it. WinPE is like a RAM-based version of Windows. So you're now running Windows in RAM. The disk drive is basically neutral. It's unlocked. And within WinPE, you run ImageX with the slash capture switch. And ImageX slash capture allows you to basically take an image of any volume you want or any sub portion of that volume, take an image of the volume, and it saves it as an image, which is called a WIM, a Windows Image Format file. And that image then can be deployed either by using ImageX slash apply onto another machine or by loading it into what's called Windows Deployment Services. And again, Windows Deployment Services is its own technology as well, but Windows Deployment Services allows you to do this. You've got the perfect machine, you've built it, you've sysprepped it. So we're at that generic state. You capture the image, so you've now got this file that is exactly what that machine has on its disk drive. You upload it to Windows Deployment Services. So you might have several different images. You might have a SharePoint server, a SQL server, a dev server, who knows what else, desktops of different kinds. In Windows Deployment Services, doesn't care what the images are. It's just they're images of sysprepped disks. And then on a remote machine, you can do something. So this is your new bare metal machine. You can do something like boot it and press F12. And F12 boots the network, discovers Windows Deployment Services through a process called Pixie Boot, and gives you the option of deploying an image down onto that machine. And it all can be done with F12. And you have all sorts of capabilities of managing what images can go to what machines and which users can request which images. So maybe your devs only have ability to choose the dev image. Your IT pros have the ability to choose different types of images. And then, again, once you start up that machine, it goes through mini setup, and you've got the perfect machine. So the deployment process uses a set of tools that might be worth learning about. They are very rich and powerful, so let me say this. Don't get caught up in their complexity. If you focus on what you're trying to do, which is capture an image and deploy it, you can sort of push away all the other noise that's around the tools, like assessing the computer for readiness. You know it's ready. You've installed it already. You don't need to do user state migration. You don't need to do a whole bunch of driver installation, probably. Especially with servers, it's a much more consistent environment. So push away the noise, and these tools actually are pretty easy to figure out. And the tools you want to look at are the Windows Assessment and Deployment Kit, the ADK, which used to be called the WAKE, the Windows Automated Installation Kit. And I don't know if you guys know this, but there's a team in Building 37 at Microsoft It's 13 people. And they're paid good money to change the name of things every version. So it's now the ADK. Then there's the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, which is used to... So what the ADK does is really capturing and deploying images. What the MDT does is it allows you to script tasks that then can be poked into those images or used to create images. So, for example, remember I mentioned that after you deploy the image of the SQL server, you're going to have to join the domain, set the IP address, and then run SQL setup one more time to finish the installation. Those you would have to do manually. But the MDT allows you to script those. Because the MDT creates what's called a task sequence, and each task can be whatever you want, including all the different little scripts and PowerShell tricks that I've shown you throughout this session. So the MDT would allow you to sequence those and inject them into the image so that the first time the image boots up, it just automatically finishes those things for you. So the MDT is about, in our context, the MDT is really useful for adding tasks to and automating tasks to your image deployment. And last but not least, WDS. And WDS you can think of as the image deployment server. It's most commonly known for the fact that if it's up there and you boot a machine and press F12, your BIOS level will connect to your WDS server. It will kick out a process that will then give you a list of images you can choose from, and you're done. So those are the tools you want to learn about if you're interested in turbocharging the deployment. So with that, I'd like to say mahalo. Thank you guys very much for coming. If you've got questions, we'll do some Q&A since we've got a little bit of time left. Or you can certainly find me after this. I also want to give a huge shout out to a list of people who I never get to thank who are a godsend to me. These are colleagues who I turn to answer questions. Many of them are speakers or here at this event. They're all amazing people. And when you get this deck, I highly recommend following these people on Twitter and Facebook. They're amazing, amazing people, and they all helped me out with my four presentations here today. I'll leave this up as the final slide here, but before I do that, just a quick reminder to please, please fill in your evaluations. They're very important to us as speakers. They're important to Microsoft so we can continue to bring you good content. So please do fill in those evals. And if you've got any questions, go ahead and come up to if you're near the middle, come up to the mic. If not, just raise your hand. And if you need to head out, feel free to do that as well. First person was here at the mic. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I have a quick question. My sysadmin wants me to install SQL and SharePoint on Windows 2012 Core. Yep. SQL was not an issue, but for SharePoint, I did not really find any documentation. Do you have any experience with that?
Yeah, I haven't actually tried that yet, but my understanding is it's not possible to install SharePoint on Core.
Okay.
Does anyone know differently? No, so, you, won't work. Yeah, exactly, won't work. So, sorry. Yeah. So one thing that was suggested is you could install in the full GUI mode, and then roll in 2012. You can roll the GUI mode backwards, and it's not quite the same as Core, but it strips out a lot of the things, and that might work. It's worth trying.
One last thing was the loopback.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, his point is on that disabled loopback tip, what the script I gave you turns off loopback check entirely. That's not technically the best and most least privileged way to do it. And the TechNet article that I have the link to has all the details, which is why I said to read about it. But one note I'll make, on most of my installations, I turn off loopback check. And the reason is we have so many other ways of watching for intrusion and monitoring and dealing with IP traffic that dealing with that, having to change the registry every time we add a SharePoint web application just is not worth it from a security perspective. But from a technically purist security perspective, absolutely, you can whitelist your web apps in the registry as opposed to turning off a loopback check altogether.
That's right. And just so you guys know, if you ever have a technical problem, on Twitter, pound loopback check,
then you
can blame everyone on that.
So he's saying if you have any problems, just look at Twitter and do pound loopback check. It's kind of like pound Adobe's fault.
Thank you.
Regarding the offline installation with the certificate issue?
Yes.
Have you tried turning off the certificate checking? Because I know there's a machine config entry.
Ooh, that's a good idea. Yeah, I haven't found a place to download that in Windows Server. It went through Vista or Windows XP, but then the root certificate updates. I tried that. If you've got a link, send it to me, because I searched all over for that specific update, and I couldn't get it.
Yeah. Try turning that off and see if
that's
that
works. That's a good idea, too. I'll try that. Thanks.
Regarding service accounts, can you offer any guidance on the unattended service account?
When you say unattended, what do you mean?
The account that when you do InfoPath, Visio, it says the unattended service account.
Oh, for like the secure store types of things?
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, it's a domain user account that doesn't.
You just use any account?
Yeah. Because it's getting permissions within your SharePoint environment and then obviously to any backend data sources, but it doesn't need any privileges
so
beyond what SharePoint
least
is.
Privilege, just yep. Domain account.
Okay, yeah, cool. That's
thanks.
An easy one.
Thanks. Great session.
Thank you. Other questions, comments, thoughts? Yes. Yes. His question is, central administration can be made redundant even on 2010, and there's blog posts up there about how to do that. Yep.
Here?
Yes.
Are the cache accounts still needed?
Yes, the cache accounts are still needed, and I took that out of this particular slide deck, but I believe the practice is exactly the same.
Okay.
I'd say that with about 80% certainty, not 100%. All right, super. If you've got any other questions, feel free to come up and ask. I've got three other sessions this week, real quick. Tomorrow, the demystified session is awesome. It's a grab bag of little things that you really need to know that are misdocumented, underdocumented, confusing, and would never get a full session of their own. So it's kind of like the real things you need to know now that you know what SharePoint can do. Bill did a great job of explaining that to us this morning. Now we'll help you figure out how it really works. That's tomorrow at one point. The second session tomorrow is automating governance, which is about how to automate things like site provisioning group membership requests. And then on Thursday, architecting governance, which is about how to create a mostly logical but also physical architecture that will allow you to present a SharePoint service to your organization. So, thank